was a recording of an interview with Mr. Chris Pritchard, the plumber. Mr. Pritchard, could you tell us just a bit of personal information, how old you are, where you joined the union movement, and so on?
I joined the plumbers union in Winnipeg in 1918. Prior to that, I had been in another organization in 1914. In 1919, the OBU strike came on, and practically all the unions in the construction industry in Winnipeg voted to go into the OBU. When it was all over, our charter was lifted, and ultimately we were all fined by the International, and finally our charter was reinstated and we went back into the American Federation of Labor. That strike upset the labor movement in Winnipeg, which in my opinion, even to this day, is not fully recovered from the conditions that prevailed due to that strike.
What would you say, what would you say is wrong with it then, in this case? When you say it hasn't recovered, from what do you think is?
Well, my meaning there is practically every union in the city of Winnipeg was on strike at that time, including postmen, CPR men, civic employees, policemen, firemen, people who were all in the pension category, especially the CPR and the postmen, men with possibly 20 and 30 years service, lost their pensions through that strike, and it disturbed the whole movement to the extent that I would still say Winnipeg has never fully recovered from that strike. Mm-hmm. Because in my opinion at that time, Winnipeg was one of the best organized towns in Canada. They have never been in that condition. It couldn't be said that they were the best organized town since that time.
I think. Well, you came to British Columbia.
You can shut this off if we don't want to.
Yeah. When did you come to BC, and why did you come to BC?
I came to British Columbia in 1925. And the reason I came to British Columbia was the construction industry and practically every other industry in the city of Winnipeg was dead. There was no work available. I came here, things were, could be called to be booming in the construction industry at least, and I went to work the first week. I came to Vancouver and worked in one shop steadily for 5 years.
Which shop was that?
Byron Anderson.
And were you a union, did you have a union position in Winnipeg when you left at all?
No, I held no position except on a small committee in the organization, a board of examiners.
But you were an active member?
Oh, definitely.
And you, what happened when you came to Vancouver in the union?
Well, when I came here, I first became, we had a strike in 1927 here for the $10, we came out on strike for $10 a day, and that was the time when I went onto the conference board of Local 170. At that time, Mr. William Watt was business agent, who is now a master plumber in the city of Vancouver. 1925, in the city, our organization approached the employers on the basis of the five-day week. The employers were not in favor of adopting that. They claimed that they would lose business, and the union proposed to show them that they would, in their opinion, in our opinion, they would actually save money, inasmuch as the Saturday morning, it was felt, was generally wasted time. Man no sooner got on the job, and it was time to go home. But further than that, we had quite a few men out of work in 1924 and 25, and it was felt that if we had the five-day week, we could put all our members to work. At that time, there was no helpers in the organization. It was purely mechanics, plumbers, and steam fitters. We finally agreed between the employers and the union to try out the five-day week for 3 months, and if at the end of the 3 months the employers could express their opinion as to whether they felt we should continue it, and the union also would state their case. However, at the meeting to decide whether we would stay on the five-day week, the employers were practically as much in favor of the five-day week as the journeymen. And from then on, our organization established the five-day week. I might say that we took a reduction in pay because at that time we were earning a dollar an hour, and we were getting 44 hours a week, $44. But we were prepared to forego the Saturday morning $4 to establish the five-day week. The strike in 1927 for an increase in pay, we finally established our $10 a day for the five-day week, which was $50 against the 44 that we were earning for the 5.5 day week. The conditions from then on till 1930 were excellent in the construction industry, as everyone knows, and then, of course, the depression, so-called, came along, and the bottom dropped out of all industry.
What about the strike? The strike you just mentioned.
The strike in 1927 lasted 9 weeks, and we had the full support of all the construction industry. While there was a lot of ill feeling created, from then on there was no strike between the plumbers and the employers until around 1947. We maintained, in my time, we maintained a conference board from 1925 on until the time I left, of 5 employers and 5 journeymen. And the idea of the conference board was to meet once a month to discuss the problems of the industry, take up any grievances, and to endeavor to create better feelings between the employers and the journeymen, and also to try and get as much work as possible into the union shops. On the other hand, if a union grievance arose, the conference board could be called within 24 hours to settle the differences between the organization and the employers. And I must say, in my time, that while still we were in a depression, we maintained the union all through those years, and I always felt that the conference board was an excellent medium settle our differences, which came up from time to time.
Now, when you joined the union here local, who were the leading figures in the local union?
President at that time was a man by the name of Bert Stinchcomb, who is now in the United States. And the business agent was William Watt, who is a master plumber in this city now at the present time. The executive board members, I don't remember their names all, but I went on the conference board in 1928, my memory serves me correct, and on the board of examiners in steamfitters examining board in 1930, and I also became a business agent in 1930.
And you stayed on till when?
1940. The end of 1941, I think.
Okay. Now, what about what do you know about the history of the local before you came? For instance, do you know when it was founded?
In Vancouver?
Yes. Yeah.
I think our charter goes back, but our charter will show that. I think our charter goes back to 1898. I think our charter here was established in 1898. We were the first union in the construction industry, and perhaps in any other industry for that matter, in this province to establish the five-day week. It was many years after before any of the other trades in the construction industry went on the five-day week. And the plumbers, in my time as business agent, I had quite a time explaining to contractors why our men were not on the job on Saturday morning. They couldn't ever understand why the plumbers were not there when every other trade was there. Finally, of course, we all know the construction industry went on the five-day week. Well, following on that, if we want to carry on the hours of labor, I attended a convention, an international convention of the plumbers in Atlantic City in 1938 with one other delegate who was the president at that time, Bob Simpson, who is now passed on. And we presented a resolution on the floor of the convention for the six-hour day to be written into our constitution. John Cofield was the international president at that time, and the resolutions committee of the convention were not prepared to accept the resolution and place it before the convention as to whether we should adopt the six-hour day. However, the resolution stated that we should endeavor to obtain a six-hour day wherever possible.
What about the relations of your local in the union? For instance, it said that BC trade unions were a very radical lot. Did you have any problems within your international?
Just how do you mean, Mr. Pigott, within our international? Do you mean within Local 170?
No, I meant that, not you personally. I meant that your local as a group. For instance, were you different from the? Did you have any differences with the international?
No, I would say during my time as business agent, we had the best of relations. Thomas E. Burke was the secretary of the Plumbers International in Washington, D.C., and I have much correspondence in this house at the present time, which would show that the most cordial relations existed between Local 170. And if we felt that we had any problems, all I had to do was to write Mr. Burke and he would immediately give us any assistance necessary. The present Secretary Treasurer of the International Plumbers and Steamfitters, William C. O'Neill, was at that time an organizer on the Pacific Coast. And if we couldn't get Mr. John Bruce, who was our Canadian representative, whom everyone knows, then Burke would send up William C. O'Neill. I also was on the international payroll from time to time as a representative of the international, especially from 1938 on, after war broke out, until the time I went on to the Workmen's Compensation Board. I was doing organizing, especially on the island, on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis. I wasn't a permanent international representative. But I did do work for the international if we could not get an organizer up here at that time. So when you ask me, did we have good relationship with the international, I would have to very definitely say yes.
What about your organizing in the province? What other locals?
How did
the union develop in BC?
In my time as business agent, there were only two other locals in existence in the province of British Columbia. One in Prince Rupert, which possibly had a half a dozen men, and the local in Victoria. And Local 170 had the control of all the members in British Columbia on all jobs that we could organize.
Okay.
And we had members living in different parts of the province, and they always paid their dues into Local 170's office. Personally, I found no problem, but I would have to admit that at the time that I took over, our union had dropped from 380 mechanics to 60 in 1930. However, in 1940, we had 600 members. And when I left the organization, I think it would be safe to say we were somewhere in the 800, we had 800 members. I had to do all the work for the organizing, looking after the shops and bookkeeping and so on, just myself on the job.
What about, was your local or the Victorian local, the first in British Columbia?
Oh, Local 170. The Victoria local didn't come in until after 1900. And the Prince Rupert local was an offshoot of the First War, if my memory serves me correct. But ultimately, they all came into Local 170, and then after I left, they again established another local in Prince Rupert. I might state, for information, after the Depression came on, we had to battle and go on strike for 9 weeks to get our $10 a day. Things got so bad in 1930 that in 1931 the bosses dropped us to $9 a day, or the employers dropped us to $9 a day. And in 1932 we were dropped to $8 a day. There was no chance of us opposing this because our membership had practically all left the organization. As I stated before, we only had 60 members in good standing at that time. But we never went below the dollar an hour. We maintained that dollar an hour all through the Depression days for the members that we had in Local 170. And I must say that we had the support of every member In the organization, there was no fear of a man, even though he may need a job in the worst way, of going out and undercutting the union rate of pay.
So your union was a pretty strong union in that respect.
Well, the members we had, Mr. Pigott, were real trade unionists, in my opinion. The bulk of the members were out working on their own. I wouldn't know what they were doing, but we still maintained $1 an hour for those members that belonged. We got a dispensation from the International in 1936. I wrote Burke with the idea that we might be able to get some of the boys back into the organization if we could reduce our initiation fees. And we had a special dispensation given to us of $3 to try and get the membership back. And from 1936 on, or 37, I was able to get a tremendous amount of the old members back in again on that very basis.
Well, what about the bodies, the various organizations your local has been affiliated to? You were in the TLC, I guess.
Our local at that time was affiliated, of course, with the Trades and Labor Council, the Building Trades Council, and I was instrumental in establishing a Metal Trades Council in this province in 1938. Five of us went to Portland, Mr. William Page, Mr. of the Carpenters, Mr. Harry Arbuckle of the Machinists, Mr. Dan McPherson of the Sheet Metal, and myself of the plumbers. We had to pay our own way. There was no money in the treasury. And there was at that gathering men from all the different metal trades from San Diego to Vancouver. And we set up a Pacific Coast Metal Trades at that time. We had to pass the hat round the meeting to pay for the meeting hall, but at least we established a Metal Trades Council. And our charter was given to us, I think it was 1939, and presented by John P. Fry, who was at that time the international president of the Metal Trades Department.
What about what other unions were in on the Metal Trades Council?
In Vancouver?
That's right.
We had the carpenters, the which would be the shipwrights, and we had the sheet metal, the painters, the boilermakers, the international boilermakers, the electricians, the laborers, machinists, I guess that's, I can't remember.
Were they
all? But all the metal trades.
That's right. That, were they all in on it right from the start? Or?
They all joined right at the start, but there again, trouble came along between the AF of L and the CC of L, and a split came about, and some of the trades left and went into the CCFL. The situation had got rather drastic in the Trades and Labor Council, and an international man was sent up here from Seattle with the idea that this matter should be straightened out. And at that particular meeting, when the communists were, the so-called communists were supposed to be expelled, several of the different groups or delegates left the Trades and Labor Council and joined the then CCFL group. And from then on, It was simply, to a certain extent, a certain amount of chaos existing on work, especially in the shipyards during the war.
Now, who was the fellow that was brought over from the Italian?
The gentleman that was brought over, pardon me, to carry out this job was Mr. Hughes, a member of, at one time, a member of the Plumbers Organization, the International, in Seattle. But at this particular time, he was an AFL organizer, and it was his job to straighten out this particular problem which Vancouver was faced with at this time.
Well, now, what exactly, was it just you have calmness in, or did they control it, or did they see control?
They didn't control it, but it was a matter of disrupting it, the same as usual. And coming back to the metal trades, after this had taken place in the Trades and Labor Council, then the metal trades were faced with not being able to have a 100% AFL agreement in the shipyards. Mr. Bengoff, Mr. Jameson, Mr. Schaller, Mr. McPherson, Mr. Page, and Mr. Jack Ross and myself interviewed the owners of the shipyards in North Vancouver in 1939 with the idea of getting a closed shop AFL agreement. And we were advised that they had already signed with two or three trades, one the Boilermakers, to my recollection, as far as I recollect, for in October 1939 for the duration of the war. And consequently, we never were able to establish a closed shop in the shipyards. And there was always considerable problems to be faced between the two organizations all during the war.
Now, your relations with the CCL were fairly bad, I guess. Ever since they started.
Well, our relations, as far as being an AFML man, were concerned with the Canadian organization, where we consider them an outlaw group, as far as we were concerned.
And what the plumbers were, there was never any doubt within the plumbers about them.
In answer to that question, there was not in my time. I think that it was over this very matter that I left the Plumbers Union as business agent. Some of the members in the shipyard were feeling that we should meet with the rival organizations, and at one particular meeting, a motion was passed that I attend a meeting in the Fisherman's Hall with the Boilermakers and some other group, I can't recall who. This meeting was held in the big hall at 529 Beattie Street, the old Labor Temple, and I flatly refused to attend this meeting, pointing out to the membership, and it was a full hall at the time, that I saw no reason why we should fraternize with these people in any way, shape, or form. They had undermined us, in my opinion, because the Metal Trades Department had held a convention in San Francisco in 1939, and it was agreed that the wages would be for the shipyard workers, bear in mind this was 1939, $1.07 for all mechanics and 77.5 cents an hour for all helpers. At that time, the uptown rate in the construction industry in Vancouver, the highest rate, was $1 an hour, which the plumbers were getting. And we all agreed that this was what we would present the employers with. I wrote the employers in this province following that convention and advised them that we wanted $1.07 an hour as of the 1st of January 1940 for mechanics and 77.5 cents an hour for the helpers. And we were advised that there was already an established wage in the shipyards set up by the boilermakers who had signed in October 1939 for $90 an hour plus the cost of living for the duration of the war and 50 cents an hour for the helpers. We finally had to go to arbitration, and Professor Angus was the chairman of that board, which was a federal board. Mr. Percy Bengough represented the machinists, the plumbers, and the sheet metal workers on this board, and Mr. McLaren, who was now passed on, represented the employers. And that board came up with a unanimous award of 90 cents an hour plus the cost of living bonus for the duration of the war, which we finally had to accept. But this had already been established by the Boilermakers Union in October 39. And you asked me, was there any feelings toward the other group? Well, you would have to draw your own conclusions.
What about the BC Federation of Labor? You were in that. Were you always affiliated with Maximus Card?
Yes, we were affiliated. The plumbers, according to our constitution, must affiliate with all groups that are set up according to the International and the Canadian Congress of Labor. We have to affiliate with the Building Trades Council, the Metal Trades Council, the Trades and Labor Council, the Pipe Trades Council, and the BC Federation of Labor, if there is one in effect. In my time, there wasn't one. BC Federation was not in effect and didn't come into being, as far as the AFL was concerned, I don't think until 1946. I'm not too sure about that. But James Barton, who was a member of Local 170, was the president of that BC Federation at that time.
Well, now, there was a BC Federation of Labor long before 1946. But
that was in the other group. It wasn't the AFL. The AFL was not affiliated with that BC Federation of Labor.
So you didn't affiliate until 1946?
Or whenever the AFL group were set up. I'm not just sure about that.
What about the Vancouver Labor Council?
Well, there was two Vancouver Labor Councils. Ours was the Vancouver Trades and Labor Council. The other was the Vancouver Labor Council. The councils merged, as we all know, when the merge took place between the merger took place between the AFL and the CIO.
I see. Did your union, did any of your members hold offices in the Vancouver Trades and Labor Council?
I don't recall. Oh yes, we had certain members on some of the committees. I became the secretary of the Trades and Labor Council in 1942 when Mr. Percy Bengough, who was the secretary, went to Ottawa to take Tom Moore's position as president of the Trades and Labor Congress owing to the illness of Tom Moore at that time. And I then became the secretary of the Trades and Labor Council until March 1943, when I was appointed onto the Workmen's Compensation Board.
Was that a full-time position, secretary?
Of the Trades and Labor Council? Mm-hmm. I would say it was more than a full-time position, and I would say so now that it's a full-time, double full-time position.
A bit of a salary.
Yes, I went on at $50 a week.
I see. What about the... did you have any jurisdictional disputes at all? as far as you remember?
In my time, we had many jurisdictional disputes, but not of too great a degree, I would say. But generally, and I have no recollection of any disputes that the plumbers ever got into that we were not able to settle satisfactory to all concerned.
Without a strike.
Definitely.
Yeah. What about the political angle in your union? Your union didn't take part in politics, I guess.
No, our organization never took any part in politics except in 1933 or whenever the CCF was formed, which I'm not quite too sure about. CCF clubs were formed around this city and province, and lots of our members joined these various clubs. I belonged to one right here in Point Grey at that particular time. But we always tried to keep the politics out of the organization to the extent, as far as I am concerned, that is the individual's prerogative to decide where he fits, the same as his religion or any other personal matters. We never had any problems over the politics, as far as I can recollect, because generally speaking, if someone got into a political argument, the chairman immediately ruled it out of order, so there was no problem anyway.
And so in effect, your local steered clear of all the various labor parties and socialist parties that were formed in the province.
Yes, but we had members who were in these various parties. I belonged to some of them myself. I might say that I voted for J.S. Woodsworth in the city of Winnipeg the first time he ran and was elected to Parliament. And the same with John Queen, Fred Dixon, Mr. Tanner. All those people became members of the legislature in Manitoba, and some in the federal house. Because a man doesn't go around with a badge on his arm saying he belongs to a political party doesn't say that he doesn't support that political party, does it?
No, I agree.
I maintain at all times, if more people done more voting and less talking, we might get a Labour Party elected.
Well, me too. What about, you just mentioned a number of these people from Winnipeg. Now, people like Woodsworth came out to the coast. For instance, Woodsworth and Bill Pritchard and Malcolm Bruce. I was wondering, do you have any recollections of them? What is your impression of them?
Well, I have listened to Mr. Woodsworth many times in the old days, because in my time in Winnipeg, where the old City Hall used to stand on a Sunday, it was a common thing for any one of these people to get up on the soapbox and discuss the problems of the day, somewhat similar to the Hyde Park corner in London. And Winnipeg was a very labor-minded, perhaps a socialist-minded city at that time. Fred Dixon was a personal friend of mine. John Queen I know very well. Bill Pritchard is no relation of mine, but I knew him very well. And I saw him in Vancouver some 10 years ago, the last time I was talking to him. But I have two books in my possession. One is Fred Dixon's address to the jury, and the other is Bill Pritchard's address to the jury when they were tried in 1919 for so-called sedition over the OBU strike. And it would seem to me that Those are the kind of things that Labour perhaps should find time to read, because they disclose some very valuable information, as far as I'm concerned, as to where we stand, and also what our freedom amounts to, and that we should not be too ready to give it up. And in that direction, I feel that the Labour movement has given a lot of its freedom up on the basis of the type of legislation that we have from time to time and still are requesting the legislature to put into effect. In my time as business agent, there was no such thing as having to get a government supervised strike vote to see whether you had the right to organize. You either sold your union or you didn't sell it. But as far as I am concerned, that is still the best and proper way to handle our trade unions. If you can't sell your union to the guy, then perhaps it isn't worth selling.
Well, as a matter of fact, I read one of Pritchard's books that you just mentioned, and Pritchard did play a very active role in British Columbia.
Oh yes, he was Reeve of Burnaby. That was all after. I'm talking about 1919. I wasn't here then. Mm-hmm. Oh yes, so did Woodsworth.
What were your what do you think of Bill Pritchard? What kind of a fellow was he, in your opinion?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I would have to put it this way. He knew the workers' position in this form of society, which was him. He knew what he was talking about. That doesn't have to mean that one agrees with everything that he said, but he certainly was capable of stating the position of the workers. So was Mr. Woodsworth.
Do you remember Woodsworth being in British Columbia? He worked here as a longshoreman.
I was in Winnipeg at that time.
What about, say, Malcolm Bruce? Did you know him?
No, not too well. No.
Well, what about, say, Percy Bengel? Now, you certainly knew him.
Yes.
What do you think of his role in the labor movement in British Columbia?
Well, all I can say is that he has done a grand job for the labor movement in this province, regardless, without any question of doubt.
Well, maybe I should go on and talk about, you mentioned that you were appointed to the Workmen's Compensation Board.
Yes.
When was it exactly?
I was appointed in March 1943. But prior to that, Mr. Pickett, during the war, there were wage control boards set up and price control boards. And I was on the Regional War Labor Board for British Columbia when it was first appointed. The employer's representative were Mr. Boss Johnson, who later became Premier, Mr. Sid Smith of Bloedel, Stewart & Welsh, and John Tucker of the Dominion Construction Company, company represented the employers, and Mr. Horace Mackey of the Railroad Locomotive Engineers represented the railroads. Mr. Lish Campbell of the Boilermakers, number one here, represented the all Canadian group, and I represented the AFL. That regional board functioned under the chairmanship of Mr. George Pearson, who was then Minister of Labor, and Adam Bell was vice chairman. We had to endeavor to keep the wages within line according to, on a comparable basis. If wages were increased, let me put it this way, we had to have something to raise them up to, that is, on a comparable basis. Do I make it clear?
That's right.
And in many, many instances, I would say that we did a pretty fair job, because many groups were brought to our attention which were receiving wages even at that time, which were unbelievable, and naturally they were not all organized groups, because we had to deal with non-union as well as union employees, and some of the wages being paid in some of the industries in this province were, to say the least, somewhat scandalous. Also, it would be my feeling, and I don't suppose anyone else would agree with me, that during all those years that the Price Control Board functioned and the Wage Control Board functioned, it would be my opinion that the worker was better off to this extent, that the wages that he was receiving, he was certainly able to purchase practically the value of his dollar, because the prices were being held at the same time as the wages were being held. And while the plumbers were getting a dollar and a half or $1.75 at that time, in 1943 anyway, I would say they were equally as well off as they are today with the wages that they're getting and the prices that we have to pay to live. Whether anyone else agrees with me or not, it doesn't matter. I'm just stating my position as I see it. Prior to going on the Compensation Board also, there was a Royal Commission appointed here, because the steel industry, a big industry, decided that to pursue the war to a successful conclusion, the shipyard men should work 7 days a week on a straight time basis. And immediately this was put out, an uproar arose, and a Royal Commission was set up by the federal government under the chairmanship of Mr. Justice Richards from Winnipeg, and two employers, Mr. Hugh Lewis of the Burrard Yard and Mr. Don Service of the Salvage, who I think are both passed on, and Mr. McCausland, Alec McCausland of the Canadian Congress of Labour, and myself representing the American Federation of Labour. We sat for many weeks, went all down the coast, visited all the shipyards, and the final outcome of that was that the agreements were lived up to and so on. But there were many arguments presented by the employers at that time as to why the worker should give up all the conditions that he'd ever fought for to pursue this war to a successful conclusion. However, I pointed out in my report to the government that we could do that quite easily under the terms of the agreement that we had signed in 1940. And finally, the agreements were lived up to. Then I, of course, got out of the labor movement and went on to the Compensation Board, as previously stated, in 43. That didn't mean that I severed my membership, because I stayed as a member of our examining board for 2 years after I went on the Compensation Board, that is the Steamfitters Examining Board. But my membership was continuous up until this present time, and I attended meetings and so forth. Going on the Compensation Board, I was perhaps as much surprised as any man in British Columbia when I was broached to put my name in for that job. The Trades and Labor Council were asked to submit three names. The Vancouver Labor Council were asked to submit three names, and I think the railroad groups were asked to submit three names by the government at that time. And I was appointed, I suppose, by good luck. I never sought the job. And I stated to Mr. Pearson, when he suggested that I let my name go, that I was quite happy where I was as Secretary of the Trades and Labor Council of Vancouver. However, a lot of my friends suggested that I should go for the job, so I took it.
You were nominated by the Vancouver...
Vancouver Trades and Labour Council.
And...
Three names were sent in. Harry Nealands, Bert Schauer, and mine. And I know the names of the other groups, but that isn't worthwhile mentioning.
And did they appoint all three, or they just chose one out of the three?
No, you could only appoint one. I mean, there was three names to be submitted by the Vancouver Labour Trades and Labour Council, you see.
And the government chose...
There was nine names submitted from three labour groups here, you see. Three from each group. The government asked them to submit them. And mine was one from the Vancouver Labour Council, and I got the job. And I found it most interesting up to a point, and I well remember George Pearson saying to me, it'll be no sinecure, Pritchard, and I found that out, because it is no sinecure if you want to do a job for what for the people that you're supposed to represent and in their best interests. I endeavored to do that up until the time I left.
Now, are you dissatisfied, or were you dissatisfied with some aspects of the workman's compensation?
I've never said very much, Mr. Pickett, as to why I left. And I don't think that I want to say very much now. Any more than well, let us say too much interference from the outside. Let it go at that. What was inside, I felt that I could take care of my position at all times. I knew where I stood, and I never was pushed around or wouldn't stand being pushed around by anyone. If I made a decision, rightly or wrongly, I made it the way I saw it. And that was the stand I always took on the board. I made many mistakes, undoubtedly. But if I did, I did so and called it the way I saw it, regardless. I might say to on the while I was on the compensation board, it was my part of my job to take care of the look after the industrial first aid of this province, and also, of course, to a certain extent, the safety end of it. And I visited practically every corner of this province, and where I could have and where they would let me, addressed labor groups and employers groups on the basis of the importance of and the value of our act, and the necessary support that should be given by employers and workers as far as the regulations and the act itself for their own good. I have always tried to preach to the workers of this province that safety is paramount regardless of anything else. And while we have battled to increase the benefits, and they have been increased, maybe they're not enough yet, but let us never forget, if there were no accidents, there'd be no compensation. And my contention is that when a man goes on a job, the first question that he should ask the employer, is this a safe job to work on? Because I have found out in my experience with the compensation board that the cheapest thing that an employer can get is a workman loss of a workman or the loss of 10 workmen or 20 workmen on any job never tied a job up. The loss of a costly machine or the holding up of a costly machine, the employer is most concerned about, but a workman, that is another matter. Therefore, it is the workman's responsibility not only to himself but to his fellow workmen and his family, his wife and children, that he go on the job with his lunch pail and go home at night with his lunch pail and not go home on a stretcher or into a hospital. And the regulations are such today, in my opinion, as a former member of that board, that any group of workers in any part of this province, be they organized or unorganized, if they feel satisfied that the condition is unsafe, I don't care whether they're drilling a tunnel or whether they're topping a tree or whether they're working in a paper mill or whether they're in a sewer or whether they're on construction. The law is there to protect them, and the compensation board must uphold any group of workmen who refuse to work under an unsafe condition. But I am sorry to say, too many people are prepared to throw caution to the wind and take chances. But the man who loses a leg or an arm or an eye, I have always said and I say now, there isn't enough money in the province to pay that man for that loss. Because why? He immediately becomes a derelict in the labor market. He has no possible chance of getting a job. He isn't wanted in this competitive age. Therefore, I say again, one of the most important things in this province, while the Compensation Act is necessary, under that act, the worker has full protection, I repeat, so that he doesn't become injured on the job. I can recall that terrible disaster we had in the Second Narrows when 18 men were killed. The concern mostly, one could say, was possibly over the loss of the steel in the water and the equipment and so on. 18 men lost their lives. Did it tie the job up? If you read the record, you will find they didn't know how they could get Mr. Gallardi's job done because they couldn't get the steel quick enough. The loss of the men, though, made no difference whatsoever to that job. The welders had no organization. The asbestos worker or pipe covers had no organization, and the gas fitters had no organization. And I ultimately got that, got the asbestos workers, the welders, gas fitters into local ones. 170 through the international agreeing that they could come into our organization in as much as there was no international covering them in this area. And rather than have them non-union men on the job and with them stating there was no place for them to go, we felt we'd take them into the plumbers until such times as they could set up their own organizations, and that was the reason that they were brought in, and I organized them in 36 or 7 under that special dispensation. I also organized the first attempt at the when I was secretary of the Trades and Labor Council, the morticians in this town, and that was quite a job. There's quite a history attached to that. In 1940, appointed by the federal government at that time, it was composed of 30 contractors from all over the Dominion and 30 labor men from every part of the Dominion. And there were 3 contractors went from British Columbia, Mr. Armstrong, Mr. Fred Hale, and Mr. John Tucker, and 3 labor men, Mr. William Page, the carpenters, Mr. Jack Ross of Local 213, and myself, the plumbers. This meeting was held in Ottawa under the then Minister of Labour, Mr. McLarty. Tom Moore was present, who was at that time President of the Congress, Trade and Labour Congress, Canada, and Mr. Humphrey Mitchell, and various other notables whom I can't recall. The idea of this meeting was that the construction industry would give some sort of pledge to the government that there would be no strikes or tie-ups on federal government army or at least defense construction for the duration of the war. We met in Ottawa for some 4 days, and finally an agreement was arrived at, and I would have to say that for the duration of the war, it was pretty well carried out, because no delays or strikes or holdups occurred that amounted to anything on any construction in this Dominion during the war. In a way, it shows what could be done if employers and labor and perhaps government are prepared to sit down with their feet under the table and talk these things out. I became the first president of the Metal Trades Council here in 1939. I think I already stated that. And I was also followed Mr. William Page as secretary of the Building Trades Council for up until the time that I went as secretary of the Trades and Labour Council.
What year is that?
I became secretary of the Trades and Labour Council in 1942, September 1942. And the Building Trades Council, I went on there, I think that was 1938. And then I was always on the executive of the Building Trades Council as well, and also of the Trades and Labour Council.
What about?
After I quit the business agent's job, owing to the fact that I refused to sit in with the rival group, the meeting wouldn't listen to my, I've already said about this, the meeting wouldn't listen to my ideas, and I stated, well, in that case, give me 5 minutes and I'll show you where I stand. And I wrote out my resignation as business agent to the plumbers. And further to our activities in the Plumbers Union, Local 170, in 1926, we were responsible for bringing about a more up-to-date plumbing bylaw in the city. After much gathering of information, it was based on the acts in some of the more larger cities in the United States who had brought their acts up into to meet the requirements of present times. Out of this new bylaw, the plumbers working in the city of Vancouver had to obtain an so-called efficiency card, which was given them after passing an examination passed by a board of examiners set up under the new plumbing bylaws for the city. And it was felt that great improvements would come about in the sanitation as far as the new bylaws were concerned. The employers cooperated, of course, in this matter, and since that time, naturally, there have been improvements. But the new up-to-date regulation came in 1926. In 1934 or 35, we also brought before the City Council a matter which we felt should have consideration here, which was the setting up of a central heating plant, a central steam heating plant. The City of Winnipeg had one since 1920, and which at the present time is on a paying basis and returns considerable amount of money into the treasury of the city, which is beneficial, of course, to the taxpayers of the City of Winnipeg. It was felt that here a similar undertaking would not be too costly. Furthermore, with the amount of coal available in this province, that central heat could be produced at a fairly reasonable rate. However, nothing came of it, and the matter has never been taken up since that time, to my knowledge. Also in 1938, we petitioned the provincial government to raise the provincial plumbing code, and the idea was to establish a plumbing code in the province on a uniform basis. Also, wherever possible, to eliminate the use of septic tanks. The then Minister of Health listened, but no action was taken at that time. But it was the feeling of Local 170 that it was high time that changes should be made in that regard. We also have taken up, around that time, the matter of, before the government, of installing sprinkler systems in all public institutions, such as schools, hospitals, and the mental institution, in places where older people are gathered together in large numbers. The union, I presume, is still agitating for this to become controlled by legislation, but apparently so far the government has not seen fit to do anything with this type of legislation.